All right, so today I want to talk again about convection and massive stars. So yesterday, Raphael did a great job to introduce the problem, and he discussed a lot about what he called convective boundaries and convective boundary mixing processes. And today I want to just go a little bit, go back and talk about mixed inland theory first. So convection inside convective region, we will not discuss the boundaries, but we will discuss the assumptions behind mixed inland theory. So I want to go back and then give a little bit of a primer of MLT and see where MLT is supposed to break down in massive stars. And we'll see that this happen in regions that are radiation dominated and relatively close to the surface. In a sense, I want to do the best job possible to introduce another talk that's going to be later today, Liam Fay will give, where he will discuss, I would say, the status of the art in terms of simulating the convection in a radiation-dominated regime, which we'll see is relevant for the problem of massive stars.
When and where?
I think it's at 4 p.m.?
4 p.m.
Yeah, in Broida.
Physics department, yes.
Yeah, physics department, so third floor. I think we can all leave together from here like 15 minutes before. So I'll try not to steal your thunder, Yan Fei. So I'll show a little bit of results, because I think otherwise I'll be teasing too much, but I will not go in depth into discussing the details behind the 3D radiation calculation, including magnetic fields that Yan Fei will show later, so you can keep all the good questions for him. What I will do, I'll start discussing a little bit the problem of convection in a massive star. And obviously, what I will do, I'll discuss this in the context of the mixed inland theory. So this goes back, obviously, to the work for Biermann. One, Vitens, and Born Vitens. So you already see that this theory has stood the test of time for quite a few decades, more than half a century actually. The fact that we're still talking about MLT means that MLT does a very good job in certain environments. And most importantly, if MLT wasn't doing a good job, we will not be here discussing stars, because it will be very hard to talk about evolutionary time scales, where you have to require a theory that is able to capture process depth and on a dynamical time scale. So the beauty of MLT is that it's able to make a process which is inherently non-local and turbulent into a formulation which is local and can be applied to a 1D star. And the whole idea is basically looking at a blob of material moving in a convective region by length L. The blob has a temperature, pressure, can be compared to the external regions. The very big assumption that is always made that's going to be relevant for us is that while the blob move about a certain distance L, which we'll see is the mixing land distance, before it is completely mixed into the surrounding and releases extra temperature and therefore energy content, we assume that the pressure outside and inside the blob are the same. So we assume hydrostatic equilibrium between the blobs. And this is fine. As long as the blob has enough time to stay in equilibrium, which requires the blob to move with a velocity that has to be velocity than the sound speed. If that relation is not true, then we're not sure anymore that the blob retains hydrous equilibrium. You might end up in a situation where the convective velocities become comparable to the sound speed at that point. You can imagine that that's not true anymore. You might have shocks, and then you have to include things that are not inside an MLT theory. So what I want to do now is use this assumption and calculate a couple of quantities that are important, and then actually the most important quantities that are required inside solution models to calculate the stall structure, namely the convective flux and the convective velocities. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to calculate convective flux, calculate convective velocities. And then I'll discuss convective efficiency. Once I'm done with this, I will move to most interesting part, which is convection near the Eddington limit. Reason why we want to do that is because obviously R stars, the massive stars, live in a parameter space where some of these layers can reach and even become have a luminosity larger locally than the local Eddington limit. This has a number of consequences that have been explored in 1D solution codes, and they're only now starting to be explored in 3D radiation hydrodynamics. And the idea is that this situation might be important not only to understand the transport of energy inside the star, which will result in different conclusions for the size of the star, for example, but also for its stability and surface properties, observable surface properties, and ultimately, potentially, also coupling to the mass loss. So let's start with the convective flux. So we can write the convective flux as, because we are assuming constant pressure, we can use, this is the energy the specific energy content of the blob times the typical velocity of the blob. This is the flux transported by convection. Obviously, to calculate this, we need to have a grasp of what this delta T is. So delta T of this, across this mixing length, distance, can be written as L, approximated as L. Let's call this T prime, this T. This can be resolved into by just writing these in form of logarithmic temperature and using the definition of the pressure scale height, one can write this as where I define this gradient as obviously just to remind you that pressure scale I is defined. Yes. In the deep interior of the star, the temperature gradient of the convective element is basically the adiabatic gradient, and the reason is that in the deep interiors, convection tends to be efficient. There's no leakage of energy during the transport across the length L of from the blob into in the outside. But this we'll see is not true necessarily in the other region of a star, where the time scale for energy leakage from this blob might become comparable to the dynamical time scale of the blob, so the time that the blob takes to move across its mixing length. And that will be the situation where we will have to deal in a second. So we know that at this point there's the existence of a non-zero temperature gradient. Obviously, this implies also that there is a relative gradient and some energy is transported by radiation. Just to remind you, the amount of energy transported by radiation can be written where here K is the opacity.
Shouldn't that just be dT by dR on the first term?
dT by dR?
That should be dT by dR there.
Right. And then I can write it in the form of dlnt over dlnp.
You need to pull out another t and a gravity. And
right. So I need a g somewhere.
I think just the d log t d log p should just be grad t.
Okay.
If it was grad a t, it won't work.
So this is correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So we write that. Right, and so one can define also gradient which is required to transport the total flux, and it's a fictitious gradient, but one can calculate it. The definition of the rated gradient. And in a, yeah.
I might point out as a sideline that something you just snuck in. Mm-hmm. F can be broken up into two pieces.
Relative and convective, yes.
Right. And so you're assuming there is no other way to carry energy.
Right. I mean, you could imagine there could be another. Right. Another component, like I don't know, turbulent.
I'm just trying to point out an assumption that quietly sneaks in.
Let's say that I'm not going to make this assumption here. I'm just going to say that the total flux, whatever that flux is, imagine for a second that only radiation is transported, and then you can calculate a gradient. And I'm just put it there because you know this gradients come up in star evolution discussion. So just to put it in the context of what we're doing, and the in star convection region. What we find is that this series of relation need to be satisfied. So the hierarchy of gradients is merged in these regions.
What's that?
That's the adiabatic gradient. It will be the gradient in the blob if there was no exchange of heat with the surrounding. So now what we need to do if you want to calculate this convective flux is...
condition for convective flux, that hierarchy.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. If you want to calculate the convective flux in a convective region now, we need to make some assumption and calculate the convective velocities. And this is what is done in the MLT theory. Basically, the important point here is that so let's calculate convective velocities. That the force on a convective element is the buoyancy. And so one can calculate, can estimate what the work done by this force across the mixing length is. All the calculations I'm going to make here are mostly correct. I'm not going to include factors of order of unity, which come in this different treatment of the theory, which depends on how you define the geometry of the blob, how do you define where you calculate properties across the mixing length. You know, you can imagine that you can make appropriate averages of quantities as the blob moves, and depending how you do that, there's going to be factor of order of unity that comes into play. That's why there's a number of different implementation of the MLT theory. They all agree within a factor of a few. So this will be of the order of d delta rho L. And assuming that part of this energy goes into kinetic energy, we can say that about rho v squared convective . Now obviously we want to write this to get the convective velocities in a form that include temperature, so we can change density and temperature using the equation of state. In general, you can write this. Actually, not in general. There's another point where the assumption of hydrostatic equilibrium within the blob enters. QR, just to remind you, is general. And B is the beta is the gas over beta. If we do this, we can calculate the convective velocity as I use the delta t coming from the previous calculation. Notice something pretty important at this point, that Q depends on the ratio between the gas pressure to total pressure. So in situation where the gas pressure goes to zero, so region is radiation dominated, Q goes to infinity, which means that also the convective velocity go to infinity. This is a property of radiation dominated regions. The mixing length theory to transport the energy will try to accelerate, to speed up the convective motion and violate it's our assumption, because we'll enter a regime where the convective velocity wants to be supersonic. So putting this together, let's get into the generals. And finally, plugging these two together, we get the value of the convective flux, which I'll just put the scaling, goes as Q T rho phi. And the important part is L squared. There's a G squared. So, this is the amount of flux which is transported by convection according to the MLT. Now, as discussed before, this is assuming that one can calculate this theory and actually come up with an iterative method to calculate consistently velocities and flux, even in the situation where convection start be leaky, so it start to be inefficient. What that means, the idea is that as the blob moves, as I said before, it will lose part of its energy before it's mixed at the distance L, mixing length. Obviously, the idea is here that you have a lot of those blobs in a shell moving up and down, or, as Raphael said yesterday, more likely like non-zero example velocity, but still. So even if a blob loses heat, the heat exchange is considered horizontal. So the idea usually when people discuss this non-adiabatic convection is that the heat and it's an average horizontal, and so that only changes the transport by affecting the velocity of convective elements, but not the net vertical heat transport, as opposed to a situation where you have a grasp of the full 3D structure of the flow, allowing for radiation to move through this blob in different way than in average sense. And we'll get back to this point because it's important when we look at the simulation. Nevertheless, one can calculate, even as an horizontal average, what's the convective efficiency, which can be defined as the energy transported by the blob divided by the energy lost across L. So the energy transported we just calculated, basically. It's Cp rho delta T times the convective, times the volume of the element. The energy lost, if you assume that the loss is coming from radiative effects, we know that a blob, volume V and area A, with a temperature difference delta T, will radiate is the distance and basically also the size of the blob. This is one of the other assumptions inside the mixing length theory that are funky. So the mixing length theory, it's supposed to work in the Boussinesq approximation, which means that you will assume the size of the blob and the distance it traveled. It should be much smaller than the typical quantities that are relevant, where the quantities change inside the star. So in theory, mixing length theory should only work when it's much less than the pressure scalar. It turns out that actually we assume that L is above the pressure scalar, or even larger. Still works, but just putting it out there. So now the energy which is radiated, which is the energy lost, is basically the flux times the area of this object divided the time scale that it takes for the object to move up, which is obviously lambda over v, L over v.
It's times time.
Thank you.
I know you're just seeing for painting.
All right, so I apologize that there are a lot of mistakes here and there. Unfortunately, I prepared the talk after I was not in a good state. I had two consecutive losses yesterday night playing ping pong against Elliot, and I think that didn't help my my performance today. But anyway, move on.
One out of two or two out of three?
Well, it's 3 out of 3 if you integrate with previous game, so it's even worse. Right, so, d cubed. So we put dog together down here. We find out that the delta t cancel, and what we got left with now the volume over A, depending what kind of
delta t integrator is gone now.
Say it again?
The delta t integrator is gone.
Very good. And so basically, we got something that goes as L convective. Okay. So this is, as you can see, is a ratio of a dynamical timescale to a thermal timescale. For the people who love a dimensional numbers like Lars, this is also
what is
called
K?
Thermal diffusivity.
What about the CPU?
Yeah, so there is a I'm putting things together, and this is just a scaling.
Okay.
I just want to show that this is scales as a ratio between a dynamical and thermal timescale. So basically, this is saying that for large decay number, or for large ratio of this quantity, convection is efficient. So the amount of energy which is lost as the blob travels is tiny compared to the amount of energy which is transacted through the... Yeah.
Sorry, this is a very silly question, but I just realized I'm confused about what L is. I thought L was sort of the amount by which the blob moves typically, but it seems over there you're writing L as V over A, which I thought would be the size of the blob.
Right.
But I thought the blob moves by much more than the size. So I'm lost which one L refers to. I apologize.
No, they're similar in the mixing length theory. L and lambda become kind of the same. And I said, we've seen factor of order of unity. I wouldn't bother.
Okay, so you're saying the blob actually moves by the amount comparable to the size of the blob.
Correct. That's one of the assumptions of the mixing length theory.
Oh, okay.
Which is one of the magics.
Why should that happen?
I mean,
why is it
difficult? That's not an assumption of the theory.
sort of you just said before, that you need the blocks to be much smaller than the pressure scale. Yes. Like just that if you calibrate this to the sun or something, you see that you need that to be similar.
It's when the MLT starts to fit the calculations start to fit the observations.
I think the fact that you can get away with this means that when you have efficient convection, you know, those details don't really matter, and those details become important in the situation we're about to face. And that's where the theory breaks down.
So if I may, the K is everything to the left of volume over A over...
Define the thermal diffusivity.
Yeah.
With CP and kappa.
Another way to say it...
Everything to the left of the volume...
Think of it as convection initiates turbulence, and there's a huge range of length scales. Mm-hmm. From large scale eddies to small scale eddies. And the statement is that it's the largest scale fluctuations that have a size comparable to the scale height that dominate the transport.
Okay, that's all I wanted.
So those are fluctuations with a coherence length. It's not really a blob, but this is an interesting question. But so it's some fluctuations with a large coherence length. And then if you actually look at the simulations, it is kind of blobby, dense stuff sinking, but big, puffy stuff rising.
But also, right, in terms of the equation you get, if Matteo had never said little l in that equation for the flux from the blob, and instead of just written v over a there, you would have still gotten the same equation. Because the A's would have canceled from getting the area, getting the flux of the total energy, and then the V's would have canceled in the gamma. So, to write that equation, you don't actually, I think, explicitly have to invoke it. If you don't say L is V over A in the top equation in the right-left corner, if you leave that, you don't say L, and you just say V over A, and you do the same math, that you can still get the same statement.
Okay. So... So it turns out that this is the convective efficiency. There's another way to characterize the same by looking at a critical optical depth, which basically you can imagine that physically, as you move the blob into denser, deeper regions, the capability of the blob of losing energy through radiation becomes harder and harder for the blob to lose energy. And so you can imagine that you can calculate the same ratio by looking at by balancing the diffusive radiation flux and the convective flux. If you do so, you can recast the same criteria in the form of a optical depth and this corresponds so the limit where the optical depth is more much larger than this critical optical depth is the same limit of very large Piclet numbers, which implies efficient convection, and I'll get back to this in a second when we discuss the radiation simulation. And the limit for which the optical depth is smaller, so you're closer to the surface than this critical optical depth, which I'll define in a second, is the limit of small value of the Piclet number, therefore small inefficient convection. So that critical optical depth can be defined by looking at the diffusive radial flux, which scale as the rate of acceleration. The radiation. And the vector flux, obviously. So this is the energy in the blob, which is transported, containing radiation, which is transported by the advection in flux. And this is simply the energy leaking out of the blob as a form of radiation. This is the same way to look at the problem, but this defines, again, by equating these quantities, we get this critical optical depth that turns out to be a ratio between the speed of light and isothermal sound speed. Okay. Yeah.
I don't quite understand this talking about an optical depth in here, because I would expect the properties of convection to be completely local, not depending on how far you go from perhaps a very far away surface.
Think about it. Having this blob very close to the surface or away from the surface. From the perspective of a photon which lives inside the blob, you might be in a situation where it's easier for you to escape the blob if you're closer to the surface than much deeper.
I think the confusion, tau is not the integrated optical depth from infinity.
Yes.
It's the optical depth across the scale height. It's a local,
a
local.
Right. The optical depth across the scale height is roughly the optical depth of OB, because the scale height by definition.
It's a local.
Yeah. But the point is that in a stratified medium, the optical depth across the scale height is very comparable to the scale optical depth to infinity, almost all the densities
right.
at the highest density. I've actually thought about this a lot because plays a big role in regulating inflation. And I think part of the point is that when you get to very large optical depths, you have a difference between the radiative flux and the radiative pressure, which basically is the optical depth. And so basically what you're doing is you're affecting the radiative pressure, but the flux that you have to carry is basically the effective temperature. So it's effective temperature to the fourth over the temperature before, and that's basically an optical depth.
Yeah.
So that's another way to look at it. And what that means is that, for example, if you want to ask whether convection is important at the iron bump, that's at a fixed temperature. Well, convection will become inefficient if the effective temperature gets low enough that that ratio is small enough that tau is not big enough to beat this sound speed.
Right.
Speed of sound speed.
Yes. So the thing I want to do now is talk about the situation in which convection occurs in a superadditional layer. Yes.
Matteo, so before you do that, can I quickly ask you to show us how the Peclé number is, or the optical depth versus critical optical depth, tells us how to set Nabla prime? Because at the moment, your system of equations isn't closed. We have no way of estimating Nabla prime.
You want me to write the cubic equation for... I'm not going to do that.
At least talk about it.
Yeah, so basically, there is another equation that I've written that helps to close the system of three equations and lead to a cubic equation that then is solved into a stellar evolution code. I can put it up. I don't remember by heart how to rederive it, but it's just like another condition, and it's possible, and it's what is done into regions which are inefficient in convection. Otherwise, it's very simple. You just substitute this with the adiabatic gradient. That's what happened.
So it's the Peclé number that determines whether you're close to Nabla add or not.
So
is that right?
You know, if you go through it the way it's done in Kippenhahn,
yeah.
Right, this parameter tau over tau c is related to the Kippenhahn the parameter that he uses in his and then you basically, once you have that parameter, you can basically solve for the
flux. It's tricky because there are different derivation of the same theory. I think the last one I read was the one in Cox and Julie. They use different notation, and the form of the equation is slightly different. So if you want, I can look it up and rederive it later. It's just like tedious.
But that's why we worry about the Peclé number.
Right, so there is an equation. So this equation actually, I can write it. So basically this one leads to the following relation. So basically there is this relation leads to gamma equal some, because of the fact that the VC enters into this equation. So this is one of the three equations that are coupled and solved together that leads to the cubic that is then leading to a solution for whatever variable you use, probably gamma prime, delta prime, Nava prime. So. Yes. All right, so super-Eddington convection. And then we'll move, I'll show you a few slides of this. Let me do it here. So the definition of super-Eddington is a situation where radial acceleration is defined as is larger than the gravitational acceleration. So this means that in hydrostatic equilibrium, which I can rewrite as now this equation states that if the radial acceleration is larger than the gravitational acceleration, then the gas pressure needs to be inverted. So in super-Eddington regions, we have inversion of the gas pressure. Now, because in a star, we also know that temperature decreases outward. In the absence of any heat sources, which is the case of these outer layers of a star, we also see that then these two conditions together and the equation of state leads to d rho over dr. So a density inversion. So in 1D calculation, the appearance of super-Eddington fluxes implies an inversion of the density in the 1D solution. So what we see is that this function of radius, got these density inversions, and I'll want to show you how that works. Doing something that's never been attempted before, which is running calculation during a talk. Probably has been done.
It's done by the audience.
Yes. Multiple times. So what I'm going to show you here is a MESA calculation of the 60 solid mass model at Sol Metallisti during the main sequence, or as long as we can go. Just to remind you that the solution is provided here is coming purely from MLT. I'll show you that the alpha mixing length parameter that we chose here is 1.5, the typical value. I'll show you what kind of solution we got. And then we'll talk a little bit about what is usually done So let me tell you what we're looking at. So this is the HR diagram. The Kippenong diagram has explained beautifully yesterday from Raphael. So you see that the star has a large convective core. It's evolving. The important plots here, the yellow line is the opacity. Note this large peak here. That's the ion opacity peak occurring at about 5.3 log T, so 150,000 Kelvin. The blue line here is the density. And you can see here this density inversion occurring around the opacity peak. For the entropy lovers, I know one in the audience, the entropy. And this is the convective velocity divided by the sound speed in log. So notice that the convective velocity in the core, where convection is efficient, as you remember yesterday we talked about this, Mach number is 10 to the minus 3. In this region outside, the Mach number is about 0.5 or so. So we're getting into a situation where, assuming I just take equilibrium for the blob is probably not a good assumption anymore, whatever that velocity means, as obtained by the MLT. Blue line down here, very important. So this is zero in log. So this is the luminosity by the Eddington luminosity. You can see that everything above this line is super Eddington. So you can see that this peak here, corresponding to the opacity peaks, leads to super Eddington luminosity.
Is that, it's, you're using the total or the radiative luminosity to calculate?
That's a total luminosity.
Yeah, but it's only the radiative that makes it go above the Eddington.
So is convection inefficient here?
It is very inefficient, but I'm wondering if what I'm plotting here is, I should double check what it's plotted here, because I don't remember.
I think if you're just plotting the one that comes by default,
yeah,
that's using the total.
Okay, so that's the total.
It's a call, right?
That's telling us that it's the total, yeah. Right, but the so we can see that not in this plot, but convection is extremely efficient. So
the yellow line
in the bottom.
Okay, so the
flat inefficient.
So you can see that in this region also the gas pressure is given respect to the total pressure is less than 10%. So this is a region where I will expect convection to transport few percent of the luminosity at best.
That in the middle panel,
yeah,
there's a convection zone due to the deep opacity bump.
It pops up at some point. You
yeah, I've never seen that before.
It's very luminous. So this is something that Rich has worked before in the past. So these opacity peaks, let me tell you a little bit what they come from. This is obviously mostly ion group elements. This other bump here is helium recombination. This deep bump here is still CNO and ion group elements. These are like higher ionization states. I think it happens around a few million Kelvin, mm-hmm. something like that. It's been discussed in the context of exciting some pulsation mode. I think Rich has a paper on it. It produces a tiny convective layer at some point in the evolution of the main sequence. I know that could be interesting for trapping modes. I don't know. Right. So okay. So this is a.
Mateo, I've been doing these kinds of experiments, and I was trying for a 60 solar mass star with the default setting for convection in MESA. The convection isn't so inefficient. So I'm really puzzled by this. See different results as well. So it worked from Norbert's group.
What do you mean it's not inefficient? Depends on what assumption you're making for the MLT.
Right, for the alpha cramp, the alpha. Right. But if I said alpha to one and a half or something like that, it just gets much more efficient, and I don't get much of
Are
it.
Are you using
using probably the MLT plus plus?
This is still main sequence.
Yeah,
an MLT plus plus is turned off by default anyway.
Yeah, this is still main sequence, and we can talk about this later.
But you can still use the MLT plus plus in main sequence. It will give you different results. I can show you that. Yeah. But I would.
Plus plus is not going to make it be so. I mean, it'll be much more efficient, right?
Correct.
But you're using just standard
I'm using the stander, also showing that it was halting.
Could you put the end list on the wiki after your talk?
Yeah.
That's what the wiki's for.
So, I can calculate that later and get checked, but I think that I will expect the convection transport just a few percent of the total flux, so that the fact that I was showing the luminosity being super adding is still correct.
Is it the hydrodynamical model?
Hmm?
Is it hydrodynamical?
I believe the hydrodynamic terms are, the velocities are on, but there's no hydrodynamics happening at this point.
If your convection is inefficient, if you're superheating, you should have
No, this is still in hydroequilibrium. You have an inversion of gas pressure compensating for that. So it's consistent in
inflation. This is a question. Whether this gives you a wind or not.
I'll get to that in a second. So the existence of hydrostatic solution in 1D doesn't mean that the same solution is recover in 3D, and most importantly, in the real world.
But in the 1D case, it's not a pressure inversion, it's a gas pressure inversion.
That's what I said.
It's never
I understand. It's never a total pressure
inversion.
Yeah.
It's not a total pressure
inversion.
And the gas
that cannot happen.
You're
having trouble with that.
So it's really the radiation pressure.
You'd have to have anti-gravity to get total pressure inversion.
Yeah.
Or a shot.
So, the fact usually the mixing length parameter or the way we transport energy in this region, it's not super important, but I'll show you that this density inversion can create problems numerically, and also, you know, they impact the size of the star. So for example, different groups have been doing different things in terms of evolving stars past this phase. For example, I think Andromeda has a belief that this situation would be inherently unstable and lead to the potential washout of the density inversion. And so most of the Geneva calculation, as far as I know, are calculated using a different pressure scale height. Instead of the pressure scale height, they use the density scale height, which automatically what it's doing, as soon as the star tries to develop a density inversion, shoots the mixing length parameter to a very large value. So if you do that, let's mimic that. What you obtain is the following. The density inversion is washed out. The star is more compact as a consequence. And you get a different solution. Convection. You can see here I don't have the efficiency, but in a sense, the convection in this case is transporting much more energy. If you don't do that, you get this envelope inflation and density inversion. So this led to a discussion about what's the right way, appropriate way to treat these things. This is showing the problem. Already in the zero Gmin sequence for very massive stars, if you take a lower mass star, the problem is still there. It emerges later on as the star moves to lower temperature. But you can see that very massive star model from the Bond group, which uses, I believe, values at alpha MLT of 1.5 as calibrated for the sun, more or less. And Geneva models using the density scale light, they show different radii and different location in the HR diagram.
So just a quick point, Matteo, those putative, 150, 300 solar mass stars?
Yeah, I mean, just
30 Doradus, where are they?
Right, these are models for LMC, I believe. So potentially for, yeah, there is a sign of the existence of these stars in the core of 30 Doradus, and there's this paper from Paul Crowther from 2010 claiming that star with initial mass above 200, maybe even 300, might exist.
The blue points are from which stellar evolutionary phase?
These are zero Gmin sequence.
Zero Gmin.
So you should compare the initial points of these lines with this.
A big blue shift.
But the x-axis is not that much dynamic range.
It's not, but as I said, this is zero Gmin sequence. As the star moves To the right, this effect will be increased.
At the stage, there is no real convective, outer convective zone.
I believe there is.
Yeah, there is a little one.
But that's the one we're talking about.
Okay. Yeah.
So the luminosity is pretty much right.
My point
is on because they make convection efficiency. Yes.
So
there is a small one,
and mass is very small, but it can change completely the radius of the star because of the low density and inflation. Things might become even more complicated later on, and I'll briefly mention that. Maybe Yanfei will talk about that later. So far, I've been focusing mostly on the main sequence, but all this phenomenology might be relevant also for stars that cross the Aspirin gap and become red super giants. Because of, in that case, the present hydrogen recombination peak, which is even larger than the ion and can lead to, as well, density inversions and inflated regions. So what the star is trying to do here, and this is a nice paper from Stan was in it. So this is for a Wolfram star, but the concept is the same. So this is the density structure in the envelope, and the star is trying to overcome the fact that around 150,000 Kelvin, there is all this opacity and the flux wants to merge. So it's exploiting the fact that the opacity not only depends on the temperature, but also on the density. And so it's trying to reshape the other layers, moving them to low density in a way that, and this is the nice result of this paper, the profile basically lies around gamma equal 1, where gamma is the Eddington factor. So it's moving layers to be barely super Eddington or no super Eddington at all. And so that's why it wants in 1D to move things southward and produce this halo structure. And this paper show all the analytics that reproduce this result. So the important questions are the density inversions stable in 2D calculation of radiation-dominated envelopes? We want to know how the energy is transported in this region so that we can apply this knowledge to 1D stellar evolution calculations for understanding progenitors. And
Matteo, when you say, are they stable, do you mean, do they persist? Because, I mean, obviously they're not stable because they're Brady-Taylor unstable, and that's just convection. But do you mean, right. do they hang,
yeah,
do they
good
stay?
Point. Right. So, are they stable stationary in the sense that they persist? Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. That would be the as something I mentioned. But the first thing that happens as you cross the Eddington luminosity is you start convection. There's no way out. So, super Eddington region have to be convective. Definitely not stable.
But you don't have to actually get above it because what
you
happens,
don't have to.
What happens when you get and that go around that bump is that you get very close to the Eddington, but you actually don't cross it.
Yeah.
Hardly, you know, it's very close to gamma 1.
Yeah. In the MESA.
And then it should be convective.
In the MESA paper, in the second MESA paper, we discuss, we derive the analytics from JOS that shows exactly what are the minimal requirements to produce density inversion, convection, and finally gas pressure inversions that correspond very well to the 1D solution that I recovered. So that's understood. So what I'm going to do now is discuss a little bit. So the opacity, as mentioned before, so this is different rounds of the opacity for different values of density than what we mentioned before, as a function of temperature, going from higher to lower temperature. Again, in the inner region of the star, everything is scattering, electron scattering opacity, so the values tend to be low and constant. That's an important thing. As soon as the star reaches these regions, now the opacity has some dynamic range where you can get larger values around the temperature corresponding to the ion opacity peak. And if you cool even more, obviously you recombine hydrogen. And at that point, you get very large opacities at the surface. That's what actually lead to convection in the other layers of red supergiants eventually. It's something that we're starting to think about is also how to treat this region, what happened in a very luminous star that hits this bound barrier. And importantly, as I mentioned before, you know, different these are different lines for different density, and you can see that you can get various values of the opacity for different values of density at the same temperature, which is important.
But you should notice that it's a pretty weak dependence. You've got four.
The dependence is weak. That's why you need to go to very low densities if you want to do
the Arndt.
That's why this inflation problem is so important. If this was a large, you will change the densities by a factor of two, it will be done, and nobody will observe that. But instead, this is real. A certain star might be, for example, a Wolfram star that you guys talk about, might have a radii that are 10 times larger than what you expect. And that's important. I'm tempted to not talk too much about this. So the main point is that we wanted to know what happens in this region, and Yanfei has run calculation of the of this high opacity driven convective region, including radiation transport in a very well Eddington tensor, so solving directly the radiation equation. And we used initial condition guided from 1D solution models. We didn't map one to one. We just used the flux coming the fluxes coming from the stellar motion calculation and the same opacities coming from the Opal tables, and then created an initial structure in equilibrium in Athena. And then run and see what happened. This is the situation that we identified, this different regime of efficient versus inefficient convection. The most interesting region is this region where convection becomes inefficient, and the diffusion flux becomes radiative diffusion flux becomes important, which correspond to when the ion peak, so the ion opacity region, and so the subsurface convective region in this main sequence stars occur at an optical depth that is lower than the critical optical depth. And that's where, when these convective regions are inefficient, and you can see it here, we look at three regimes. One, deep convection, where convection is supposed to be efficient, and that's what we recover. You look at the regime where we are across the boundary of efficiency and inefficiency, and then we look at this regime where the convection is extremely inefficient. Some of you might have seen this. I'm just going to show you because it's important for a rich question in terms of persistency of this dense inversion. So you see initial condition as the dense inversion. This is created by just trying to find an initial equilibrium structure. And then as you let it go, this region becomes relatively unstable, radiation relatively unstable. And you start seeing that this dense inversion, although it's broken as a temporal behavior, which is non-trivial, in an average sense, is still present in the calculation. So what's happening here is pretty interesting. Initially, the radiation is supporting the structure. Then the structure breaks, and the change in the horizontal structure allow photons to percolate to region of lower density. So what we call the porosity of the flow, which is the flow is structured by instabilities in the flow. And this instability leads to density fluctuations. And now the photons can move through these holes in the Swiss cheese. This idea is not new, I think this is the first time this has been shown for these massive stars to actually occur in a calculation of relevant evolutionary stage. In this simulation, and I'll just skim through this because Yanfei will talk about this more later, we can recover both the advection flux, so we can measure how much flux is transported by the moving parcel of fluid, which can be compared to the MLT-derived convective flux to calibrate an efficient MLT value. But also, we can measure, and so this is what happened here. This is an important plot, by the way. So this is we can look at the volume average radiation acceleration and the density average radiation acceleration. This will be the same in 1D, but they're not the same in 3D, because now there are density fluctuations, and there's anticorrelation between the density and the radiation flux. So whether the density is low, the radiation flux is higher, and the other way around. That means that we lower the density-weighted radiation acceleration in units of the Eddington flux, if you want. It's lower than the one that you calculate from a volume average. So in a 1D, you will expect to be super Eddington by a certain amount. But in a 3D, you lower your super Eddington level by the effect of this poor structure. You're not able to bring the structure below the Eddington luminosity. In fact, the density inversion is still there, although it's less prominent.
Mateo?
Yeah.
What are the axes on that one?
This is the vertical. Sorry, that's been cut. This is the vertical structure of the simulation. So that would be the surface of the star, give or take. And this is somewhere in between the envelope of a star. So this star had a radius of about 15 or some 14. You can see here 14 solar radius. So this is actually pretty much the same dynamic range in vertical structure.
Okay, so it's sort of in a thing that's, trying to assess how much it contracted compared to the other one. It's just about a solar radius.
Okay.
You move your density inversion.
Right, so you have to be careful. So this structure here is the initial structure that you establish without any, in the Athena calculation, without any turbulence in it. So we initialize this is the equilibrium structure from the 1D,
yeah.
And then you let it go and it settle to this, because now it's, I wouldn't compare these to the 1D MESA model.
So what I'm saying. The initial condition has no convection.
There's no convection in initial condition.
It's not quite a fair comparison.
Yeah, so that's, I can show you here. You see, this is the initial condition. You need to wait for a little bit before, a few dynamical timescale before you start getting convection.
Yeah, but I mean, it's the initial condition that you would get if you would have MLT transporting energy.
No,
there, right?
No, because there's no MLT here.
I think what Pablo's asking is how different. I mean, you haven't answered it yet.
The model
has shown it, but how different? What's the impact on the radius of the star? That's the question.
Right.
So how far off is the 1D model? My understanding is that the initial condition is the 1D model.
You cannot answer that question from this. You can answer that question by extracting a couple of information from the simulation.
So Pablo, the initial condition isn't exactly the 1D model, because how do you initialize MLT in a 3D model? Right?
No, I understand that's not there, but the radial structure is in there.
Sort of, if you don't have the MLT, I mean, it's approximate.
But the MLT is equal to zero.
Yeah. But the radial structure, the density
rho of R, where does that come from?
It isn't there.
No, the rho of R is not coming from the MESA model. That's what we're saying. The only thing that comes from,
very similar to the
similar,
model.
But it's not. So we take the initial flux at the bottom.
Okay.
And then we take the opacity and we construct a profile that initially, in a structure which has not any turbulent convection going on, is in equilibrium.
And
then
you
let it go.
Gravity, right?
It's just gravity, yeah.
And
the reason why we have to do that is because what Elliot said, plus the fact that this is a Cartesian box. So the MESA models have a 1 over r squared dependence.
So I think a cleaner way to answer your question is, take alpha MLT out of the 3D simulation,
yes,
put it back in
right.
The 1D model, and ask how much does the radius change?
Right. Okay. That will be the first part, correct? So there's two effects that we see. One is the amount of flux which is advected that we can calibrate to the mixing length theory. But the other important fact that we see is that radiation now is transported in a different way that will be transported in a 1D approximation. There is this porosity effect that changes the amount of radiation energy which can leak out in the structure. In 1D, there's no way for that to be appreciated, obviously. That can only come from this 3D calculation. So you need to come up with a way to import this porosity factor into the 1D stall equation. And this is what we're working on. This porosity factor can be quantified as a value larger than 1. It would be 1 deeper in the star or where there's no fluctuation. And it can be larger than 1 as soon as you have density fluctuation that leads to density radiation flux anticorrelation. And we can measure this quantity into the 3D simulation and then port it there into 1D calculation together with the calibrated MLT. So those two things together, in theory, should be able to tell you in a better way how much energy is transported and how in this region that will give you your final radius that should be closer to what starts here, if you have done things correctly.
So what's my porosity screening all the way to the surface?
So the porosity run, the run of porosity, let me show you typical one. So sorry, this is showing the inverse of the porosity factor. It's still an older plot. But anyway, so you can see as function of temperature that the porosity factor will be, it's around 0 below the critical optical depth where convection is efficient. As you start, and you can see it here. So basically, that's the region where the two lines here correspond. So your density fluctuation don't do anything to the radiation flux. As soon as the photons decide that it's convenient for them to cross this, go into this holes, which are created by the torpedo convection, now you depart and you get your density weighted radiation acceleration being different from the volume weighted. And this ratio of these two objects tells you, give you a measure of how much more radiation is leaking outside of your model compared to the 1D structure. And this is what a typical run of that. This Yanfei will go into detail, so how this depends on different assumption of the physics. We'll see that there's some interesting result that deal with what ingredients we're putting into the models. So it might be a complicated game to play, but I think that we're getting to a place where we start appreciating this new physics that might be very relevant. Andrea.
How it interacts with the stellar winds. I guess all these processes are quite short.
Stay tuned.
All right, so that's perfect because...
But let me ask you this. This is, I think, an important thing to understand. And I know that I've asked you this in private, but I want to raise the issue. So in this classical phenomenological picture of porosity that Shabib and I have developed, you basically have this idea that in deep down, when you have structure and clumps, the photons will go around the clumps and you'll get a mass-weighted acceleration that's less. But then when you go to the surface layers, the clumps, for a given opacity, should become less optically thick, they should be more transparent. And so there should be no reason for the photons to have to avoid clumps that become optically thin. And yet your porosity reduced, your mass-weighted acceleration, the dotted line, stays below the solid line, or the black line, even at the surface where the density is very low. So there's something quite different going on in these simulations than what you phenomenologically expect. Now it could be that there's physics that we don't understand from the simple phenomenological model, but I also worry that I wonder if the treatment, the variolytic treatment, is able to handle that. But that's just something we're going to have to discuss.
Yeah.
To me, that's a very important point, that you stay the porosity factor persists even at very low optical depths.
So Stan is saying that these two curves should rematch at some point, at some optical depth.
Go to one as you go to optically thin clumps.
Yeah, I think we still need to, I still need to understand that better. I don't have a clear answer to that right now.
Okay.
But we should talk, you know, with Yang Kai about it.
Yep.
We have time. Okay. Let me quickly move on because Andrea asked, George asked about the surface effects, and I want to briefly mention that. This is just a just to close on what we were talking about. These are like three different runs with MESA, including different ways to transport energy in the convective region. The star, which is more compact, if you want, stay to the left, is the one with efficient convection, where I artificially put the alpha and LT to a large value. So I would say that the Geneva models will be more likely on this track. This is a standard mixing length, 1.5. This is intermediate. And then we have a model where we preliminarily introduce this porosity effect by importing the result from a specific calculation from the radiation hydro from Yang Fei, we're done for a star of this mass, and we check that this run of porosity looked the same between the zero Gmin sequence and the terminal Gmin sequence, and that seems to be the case. So we could use a universal formula at least during the main sequence for that, and we use the calibrated value for alpha and alpha and theory coming from the abduction flux, and this is what we get. So we got a star which is overall a little bit more inflated in this case.
So the decrease in alpha MLT is more important than the porosity.
In this case, this. But remember what we learned.
Deeply unhappy.
I'm unhappy with most things.
At this point, this is a preliminary, but this is what we can get. Obviously. As I said here, nobody feels. You will hear from Yang Fei that as soon as you put a magnetic field, it tends to be amplified. And magnetic fields increase the density fluctuation, so increase the porosity, but also increase the advection flux by magnetic buoyancy. So in a sense, you can increase the way of transporting energy, the efficiency of energy transport, so that I will expect models that even have seed magnetic fields will be more compact.
So there's something not intuitive for me here. So when you show the simulation, it will seem like the star kind of contracts, right? So the model which you consider it for your simulations is overinflated compared to mass.
Yeah, so this is again the problem with the initial condition of the simulation. You shouldn't, the initial contraction that you see in the model, in the calculation, is initial contraction corresponding to a transition from a situation where there's no convection and no energy transport.
Yeah, but so your initial condition, are they overinflated compared to MESA model?
The initial condition are not the MESA model.
But if you will compare.
We'll compare in pair and apples, because one model, the MESA model, has convection and one doesn't.
Yeah, but when you get into porosity, it contracts your initial condition, but then it overinflates MESA. So that's like a different ways how they behave. So it's very non-intuitive.
I'm not sure I understand.
I think the intuition you have is right. The initial model without convection will tend to be more inflated than a model with convection.
Yes. It will be a line that stands here, which right. There's no convection. So from that you will, yeah. But that model is nothing. Is not you cannot compare it to any MESA model calculation, because that doesn't usually is not done. You will have to put alpha mixing length theory is equal to zero, and hopefully find a solution that probably won't exist in MESA.
I'm completely confused also about that exact thing, but I would have expected all of that to go the opposite way. I would expect that when you add porosity, I would expect the state to be...
Do we understand the first two lines? Do you understand those two lines?
I kind of sort of understand those, and I have no idea where your Well, I don't know what that
okay,
is.
Okay, so let's look at those two lines. The more energy transport implies more compact structure. Okay, fine, we understand that. Now, assume that for a second, alpha MLT is 0.5.
No, I'm not willing to assume that yet. sorry.
That's what it's...
I can only assume so many false things at once.
It's not an assumption. That's how I run the model. I mean,
it's no, I understand.
You can show me the inputs.
Yeah.
I thought you said that the effect of porosity was going to essentially be like having more efficient convection, but now you're saying it's not.
I know, but he has to fight against the fact that the advection flux is smaller because in the simulation we see that less flux, I mean, the alpha makes in Lent theory efficient.
Lowering the efficiency of convection and then putting porosity
right.
in.
So the two effects are going against like each other, and apparently this one wins.
Where would a line lowers convective flux?
Where would a line be that just has a mixing length of 0.5 yeah. and no porosity?
Be further to the right.
It'll be farther to the right.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why I said, let's assume for a second that it's just it's 0.5. I want to do exactly that example.
This is not using any of the stuff that I put in to let you do porosity. Is that correct?
Say it again?
Is it just using any of the stuff that I put in to make it do porosity?
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Okay. I have no idea what's going on.
That's okay.
Well, I mean, okay, we can talk about that offline. I don't think it's...
Matteo? So I wanted to bring up the same topic I was bringing yesterday with Rafael, because that was a condition where you went from a mold that had convection into a mold that had convection, mold in 3D, and I don't know if that goes into a steady state, a proper self-consistent steady state. So I wonder here, what are the time scales that you have in your simulation, if you're resolving all of them? So you
yeah.
have the convective turn.
The good thing about here is that the thermal time scale and the convective time scale are basically the same. Actually, the thermal time is shorter by definition of the inefficient convection. So running 10 dynamical time scale, you're ensure that the simulation is in equilibrium.
So this is a situation where this is a non-issue. You're solving all the time scales in your envelope.
Yes, and obviously, you know, you want to check that you're reaching a steady state, which Yanfei did. And so in most of the simulation, we see that the behavior persists for numerous dynamical time scale. And so I think that's pretty safe with this calculation.
Okay. It is safe to say that some sort of density inversion in a time average sense is stable. You're still seeing it.
It's stable in the sense that it persists in a time average sense, but as structure and non-stationary behavior.
So this is arguing against the claim that no, any instability in that, or any density inversion would actually be unstable, would go away.
It doesn't go away.
It does not go away, which argues
you can make it go away if somehow...
I'm trying to finish arguing against Jimmy. This says you cannot use the density scale.
And you're arguing against MLT++.
Nobody knows what MLT++ is.
Okay, I'm just...
I think that there's no arguing against or for. I think that there is a reality of possibilities that depends on how efficient is the energy transport in this region, which we now we're learning... It depends on a number of processes that have to do with the way radiation leaks out and the way advection flux operates. And those things depend on the structure of the flow. And this can be only captured in a 3D hydro simulation, including radiation. And I think this is a novelty here. Now, which one of these lines will turn out to be the correct one for star HD, blah, 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 will it depend on the property of star HD, blah, 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 unfortunately.
Why couldn't you use the initial MESA model just to see how it would settle?
Well, there's two reasons. So one reason is that this is a box, the Hydra box simulation, Cartesian box, and so the run of, while MESA is using, you know, let's assuming it's very cool. Structure, so it's everything, it scales with 1 over r square, while it doesn't scale that way into the Cartesian box. So we cannot map the structure coming from the MESA 1D directly into the box.
Don't you have the option to use a spherical coordinate box so that you can literally translate?
We couldn't at the time when we started doing this. Now there is also that kind of geometry available, and we're running calculation where spherical, the curvature plays a role. which is the right place where you want to use more.
I heard you that you were running the full 3D for the full stars.
We're running big chunks of stars now, yes. But for this problem, you know, you don't need that. You know, those stars have smaller radii, so it was more convenient numerically to run Cartesian boxes. So.
But I mean, that would allow you to go to a point where this stops becoming a problem. You can
that's correct.
Put the input model there.
Mm-hmm. I don't think this is a problem, by the way. I mean,
well, I don't say it's a problem. It's just confusing. Which in itself, it's a problem.
All right.
Confusion comes new insight, or just more confusion.
So, okay, so I just want to move to, because Jan Fei will talk much more about this and will show you the interesting effects of the present magnetic fields. And just want to talk about what are the possible effects of the presence of these layers at the surface or close to the surface. And I'll focus a little bit on the ideas that these convective regions might lead to turbulence that reaches the surface as well. So the possibility of exciting both running and standing waves. And also, I'm not sure if I'll discuss this, but the possibility that magnetic fields might reach the surface as produced and by dynamo action in these regions. So this is going back to Georges' question about impact at the surface for both mass loss and other observables, spectroscopic observables like micro and macro turbulence. So this is at the optical depth tau equal 1, you can see that the structure at the surface is not homogeneous and stationary, but as velocity fluctuations on scales comparable to the scale height.
I'm really confused by this movie.
Yeah,
the scale.
Yeah, okay. it's doubling up. It's doubling up the optical depth of one. So he's showing you the rate, the surface corresponding to optical depth equal one, and then showing you where that radius is, and also showing you with color. So you could forget about this and just have this showing you the up and down. I mean, it's easier to see that this is a mountain, you know, if you have a color in it. I think it's fine. So I think there is a relevance on having this, for example, as condition that determine the region, how the wind is accelerated and how the wind is affected by density and velocity fluctuation that might come from this behavior. Also, how spectroscopic observables are shaped by potentially a behavior, a non-stationary behavior of the surface as dictated by the presence of these turbulent regions. And so, something I want to briefly mention is some work, Norbert has been involved in this work, the fact that you can measure the so-called macro-turbulent broadening in OB stars. This is an easier measurement than the micro-turbulence. Just to remind you, the micro and macro are just a spectroscopically defined broadening in the stellar spectral lines coming from motion that are either have coherent length smaller or larger than the region line-forming region, which is usually measured as a pressure scale height at the surface of the star. So this macro-turbulent broadening is telling us that there's some major large-scale motions at the surface of these objects with, the important, so I didn't put like the scale, this is, so the scale of these velocities here is of order of 10 to 100 kilometers per second. So these are not trivial velocities, they are very large. And it seems to be a trend with increasing luminosity, having larger values of macro-turbulent broadening. Before I go and explain those two plots, there is an interest in understanding this better because rotational velocity measurement, V sin I, can be strongly affected by this macro-turbulent broadening. People might miss macroturbo and Brodering for large values of V sin I. So maybe all the measurement of the rotational velocity that we have might have been affected by this process in a way that we don't understand fully. So there's, I think, an interesting work going on, especially from Sergio Simon Diaz, in trying to understand this process better. What Sergio did in this plot is showing how this correlation, how this structure of the Mach-Turbo and Brodering amplitude, as shown by the size of these dots, correlate with, for example, P and G modes excitation region, and the presence of these subsurface convective regions. The subsurface convection, obviously, as calculated in the MLT, produces velocities that are large. The larger, the higher the luminosity of the star. And of course, you can imagine that there is a turbulent pressure associated with these regions. What this turbulent pressure does to the surface, we don't know. But if you believe like the Yonsei model, maybe you can even really have a coupling between velocity at the surface and the velocities in the convective region. That might come from waves or from the fact that you get directly turbulent motion coming from the convective region reaching the surface. So this is unclear. The only thing that the work from Grassitelli and Norbert did is trying to find a correlation between regions with higher turbulent pressure, as measuring the strength of this convective region in terms of velocities, with this object. And it seems like there could be this a correlation. This is showing it better. So this is the maximum value of the turbulent pressure into this convective regions as fraction of the total pressure compared to the macroturbulent velocity broadening as measured by Sergio Simon Diaz. And there seems to be some sort of correlation between these two quantities. Now, Rich mentioned that some of the this macroturbulent broadening, or in general, velocities at the surface and even changes in luminosity at the surface might come from pulsation modes or that are excited maybe by internal gravity waves, potentially from, for example, the core convection or the subsurface convective waves. Tamara Rogers, for example, have calculation where they look at the effect at the surface of having this excitation of gravity modes at the from the convective core. There is this really interesting result here that I'm going to discuss in a second, and that's going to be the last thing I'll talk about, that I think points out nicely to the fact that the subsurface convective regions might have a dominant role, at least in shaping the macroturbulent broadening as compared to the waves coming from the excited from the convective core. So this is showing the broadening for some massive stars without magnetic fields and with magnetic fields. So the important point in this OB stars is that all broadening from these two stars, is coming from macroturbulent. The rotation period, as you can see here, is extremely slow for this star here. So the whole width of the line coming from this macroturbulent broadening at the surface. But if you look at the star with a stronger dipolar field, this is one of the strongest fields observed in OB stars, you can see that now the broadening is all coming from the splitting, from the Zeeman splitting. And there's zero macroturbulent broadening. The idea here is that maybe the
5 kilometers.
Five, okay, thanks. Very low. I think it's basically, yeah. What's the error bar on that measurement?
Is 5. I was thinking about
Can you go back to the one?
Yes.
kilograms has been measured.
That's the that measured value from a spectropolarimetry. Now, so what is interesting? You can assume, like looking at this magnetic field at the surface and assuming that this magnetic field is anchored below, that you might want to look at the region where the magnetic pressure becomes comparable to the gas pressure. Why you want to do that? Well, the idea is that in the regime where the gas is dominated by the magnetic field, that any movement will have to do work against the magnetic field, and it will be very hard for any motion to occur. So you can look at what this condition compare in terms of temperature. And so for these stars here, it all starts with magnetic fields that are not strong enough to freeze the outer layer of the star down to a depth that corresponds to the temperature where the ion convection zone emerge. This is 150,000 Kelvin. So this starts with this magnetic field can only freeze down to a few tenths of thousand Kelvin. However, the one that has zero macroturbulence, because of the very large magnetic field, actually can freeze down to the location where the ion convection zone is. So maybe what's happening here is that this star produces a region that is either non-convective or where convective is not turbulent, so that the turbulence in the convective region cannot excite the macroturbulence as observed in this other region. I thought this was a neat result that pointed toward that direction. I think I talked way too much, so I think I'll stop here. And we can discuss more some of this if you want.